if you found it necessary for emphasis or for change of pace to bring in a bit of conversation,
certainly,
just here and there, and do it so far as you could on the basis of that we didn't meet specifically in an office, but that we had a casual meeting and these things came up.
Right, sir. I can do that. Entirely in your hands. I can take all the curses of being exclusive off in a quite simple manner by writing it, as you say, as a narrative, and also showing it to Mr. Chan.
For example, after all, this would not be dishonest because of that over the years we've seen each other frequently.
That's right.
Therefore, you have picked up and gleaned my views on this thing from time to time. Matter of fact, it probably wouldn't hurt your eye at all to throw in a touch of Sicily right on through the war and since. And then, without saying that we actually met, say that on one occasion, my question was, then his answer was,
sure.
And then if you could do it that way, it would. I'm still a little fearful of establishing a precedent in my
The chief thing that gets you all that hooked, General, is that this is a magazine article, not a news dispatch, and you can be assured that I can handle it. So it has none of the atmosphere or the tone of a sudden pronouncement.
Yeah.
It can be done almost in essay form.
Yeah, and But Mrs. Eisenhower had two very bad experiences. Her magazines, one of them was, I don't know magazines, one of them. They were quite nice, these slick paper magazines. And one writer showed up that she thought no friend of hers. Well, when it appeared, the magazine people themselves almost completely suppressed this name. What was it? Not Sylvania or somebody, something. I don't know. And just put by Mrs. Dorothy Eisenhower. She was friendly. And it was only when you got down to the bottom of the bay that you said you found out. It was very bad ethics.
Oh, that's all very well. And you know, things have gotten to the point where you can't believe that anybody writes anything anymore. Half a dozen of the books by your esteemed and celebrated colleagues are ghost jobs.
Matter of fact, one man told me he's never written anything. He just used a ghost.
It just is lost to journalism.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that was best was some of the. The articles were quite nice, and she got much mail, but she'd have, in each case, sit down and say, I'm sorry, but I have nothing to do with this, because next thing you know, she would have offers from magazines, well, you've done this, won't you please do this for us, and then they want to go. Anyway, you can start it here, and we'll see. Is this the...
That's the original letter I wrote, Mr. McCann.
Yeah, is this the kind of line you want to follow?
Yes, more or less, but I'd really leave it up to you, General. Just a general discussion on war and peace, whether there can be any solution to this past the world is in without sacrificing interests. How you see peace, if any, and some of the little specific questions suggestive enough to let you say almost anything you wanted, and I'll be off the careful.
You know, probably one of the characteristics of philosophy is that the chain of philosophical reason never reaches a final source.
Yeah.
There's always something else that might have been a motivation. Now, when we begin to consider peace and war, John, we are really saying, is it possible to remove from mankind's philosophy, every deployment of force? Now, when you carry any argument to the extreme, you always find it to be false. So instantly you recoil from that one.
by saying, why, behind the pronouncement of every judge in our land, the county judge is the sheriff's posse, there's force. Behind the Supreme Court is finally the full might of the power of the United States, the law enforcement agencies, and if necessary, the whole army of the United States, to, if an emergency is declared, called out, for instance, in such emergencies as the Chicago strike of
1910.
Yes, yes. Now we get into the international theater, where we do not have a force of custom, feeling of loyalty to a single organization. And we want suddenly to abolish all thought of force from the world. Now the United Nations conception is a recognition of the fact that cannot possibly be done, because the United Nations does theoretically place behind the pronouncements of the Security Council and the General Assembly a police force. Now that police force can be effective under present conditions only if all the great nations go almost completely disarmed. Because in my mind, it would be impossible to think of having contingents from each nation, each of the members of the nation, spread their loyalty would be to this nebulous thing and not to the country from which they belong. I believe we have not progressed that far, and it is something. Therefore, my first remark about the possibility of peace is, it is just as close as is the readiness of all the great nations to disarm, and it's just as far away as their refusal to do so. A very unsatisfactory, a very, I'd say, useless, futile aphorism. But there it is. That is exactly, that expresses more than any other way in which I can quickly think of the situation in which the world finds itself. Now, if we therefore recognize the United Nations for what it is, in a way, I think it's one of its great values, is a symbol of the eternal longing of people in the mass to get away from war. People, in general, don't want to contemplate the sufferings, the dangers, the privations of war. Of course they don't. But into the organisms in which we are presently combined and segregated, these mass desires or mass misinformation, whatever it is, occasionally leads to war. Therefore, we come back to this, that we have to consider our problem that you pose today in more or less the light of history and not of the light of the great valued hopes that we developed before, too, before that. But I think
we have to be realistic.
Right? Wishful thinking is going to get us nowhere at the moment. Although, I'm for one, I do not decry wishful thinking, because it constantly keeps before you a goal, an aspiration. I think probably, as we went through World War II,
wishful thinking is really just a name for idealism.
Well, possible. As we went through World War II, time and time again, there seemed to be such evidence of the futility as well as the horror and suffering of war around us that possibly we got too great a conviction that humanity would at last reject the war settling in. And therefore, our letdown, and the letdown of the people of Berlin, is even greater than those who stayed at home and built up all that hope. This is the last one. And then when it saw that it wasn't, well, tough difference. I mean, it's, we're no worse than we were before. But we are definitely worse than we were before. If for no other reason,
I would say two reasons. One, the extraordinary destructibility of the weapons that we now have, and secondly, the fact that we grow closer and closer together and more dependent upon each other, and therefore more and more likely to develop fixes. Intelligence of man doesn't seem to be directed toward the abolition of these frictions, but just toward identifying. Now,
interlock them.
That's right. And of course, if you've got a highly complicated machine, it may be more effective in certain instances than a simpler one-cylinder job. But it's also got more valve springs to break, more wiring to blow out, more things to happen to it, you see. All right, that's what we are today. Now, therefore, if we stay, you might say, right in the pragmatic field, just look at things as they are, as nearly as we can, honestly. We say, well, what is the difference between the fact? Well, one of the great differences is that our hopes of that time, even sometimes our early beliefs, that we were going to be able to build a practical bridge between ourselves and the Eastern world, even if we could not eliminate the gulf that separated us from it. That has disappeared, at least for the moment. And the success of this aggressive doctrine of communism is held before our eyes constantly, particularly in terms of Chinese involvement. All of the Eastern European countries seemingly now practically made a part of the parent country. And then also another factor that's very disappointing, we thought that we were vastly ahead of the rest of the world in efficiency of weapons, if people were going to choose force as an armature, and now we have been forced to conclude that others have made like advances. Now on the other side of the picture, there are certain facts or incidents that relieve some of the blindness of the picture. Iran, if you recall, only a few years ago, was a terrifically touchy and dangerous spot. What was the name of that city, the North Abbey by Jams? Why, it became almost a word used in our newspapers every day. We watched it fearfully as possibly going to be signifying a new Sarajevo, or however you pronounce that word. That's what I was going to say. All right. Iran's situation, while not completely happy for them, or completely cleared up, is certainly far better than it was then. You can say likewise for Turkey, say very much the same for Greece, and the high tide of communistic appeal in Western Europe has seemingly receded, and it isn't. I'm certain it isn't merely a question that it has been temporarily lowered, even before Marshall Plan became fully effective in those countries. There has been a record of, let's say, practical cooperation in the countries of the Atlantic Pact, in that at least they see their problems, their dangers together, and they are combining not for the purpose of enforcing their will on anybody in the world, but of making certain that they can pursue the rights
and privileges of free countries. And that's all they're doing, which means to defend themselves. This has had a tremendous effect in Western Europe, although I think that many of us possibly expected too much from ECA in too short a time. We are trying to make people self-sustaining in a competitive world. And yet those people who are trying to make self-sustaining endured at close range two wars, occupation by the enemy in many instances, and therefore destruction of productive plants, loss of millions in many instances, loss of faith, loss of cohesive influences, and so on. And you cannot quickly restore such organisms to that level of efficiency that will allow them to make their living without in any way depending upon us. But I do believe this, that the ordinary American approaches that problem today not in terms of starry-eyed altruism and doesn't think of himself in that way, or of his country. He's thinking, we are trying to help Western Europe because it is necessary to our own well-being. We hope, at least, we're approaching it from the standpoint of enlightened self-interest. And probably, as an aside, that's about as high or an idealistic an attitude as the ordinary human can assume. I'm quite sure that if I were certain I were acting according to the enlightened self-interest, my heart would not longer be troubled. I would go with perfect confidence. But every man that studies these problems earnestly, if he's honest, and unless he is completely stupid, must realize that he cannot always be certain of his answers.
Right.
They are too complicated. There are such diverse things that come into it as the temperament of a herdsman in Iran, the attitude of a professor in the most intellectual university in the world, a coal miner digging coal in Pennsylvania, the desire of some politician to be re-elected, the desire of a manufacturer to make inordinate profits. All of those things enter this complicated problem and many, many thousands of others. A starving child and someone else living in unwarranted luxury.
Very hard to tell what self-interest is.
That's right. That's what I'm trying to say. The conflicting considerations makes it more and more necessary that you find simple guides for yourself. And I know of no better base from which to start than the conviction. First, the United States and all people who think like her want peace. But secondly, their scale of values is such that they put freedom, national freedom and individual freedom above all else. And the one thing that they will not sell out is that freedom, that opportunity to conduct their lives under free institutions. And for those, they will fight. And that is the one thing that will overwhelm their desire for peace.
Right. Very, very good, General. Very good indeed.
Now, a war, of course, is coming. Napoleon cynically said, God is on the side of the heaviest battalions. Well, I personally have a deeper and a greater faith in that. I believe that in the long term, working out of whatever divine plan is set up for this earth, that truth and good must eventually come. But I know nothing of the travail, the labor, the disappointments, the bitter disillusionment of any particular era or any particular generation of mankind must go through in the working out of it. And we are finite, and we can work only on a finite basis.
Do you think that God wasn't on the Dunkirk side, on the British side for Dunkirk, all over the battalions were all on the other?
That is, of course, Napoleon would have explained his aphorism or his statement in this way, that for that moment, at that time, the British were more efficient than their enemy. Therefore, God was still, because he meant heavy battalions.
Yeah.
He was also cynical enough to say, in war, men are nothing. One man is everything. Well,
if he were present today, he might say that industrial capacity. But even that isn't completely correct, is it? Because
he probably. I don't know. Maybe we're in a very speculative world. But the philosophy of the man that allows no standard, no moral or ethical standard, to his ambition. Now, the Duke of Enghien, if that's the way to pronounce it, E-N-G-H-E-N, such incidents as that, his divorce of Josephine, and all the other things in his sudden declarations of war, so, were clearly pointed to the fact that he didn't allow anything to stand in the way of realization of ambition and force. Now, of course, out of all this, if there is any thing that emerges, it is that ordinary people like you and me, what can we do about it ourselves? What can we do about it? Well, of course, I think this. Here it becomes necessary to think, not purely in pragmatic terms, not purely in the force of the moral. And therefore, I should say the first thing to do is unashamedly to make vocal and vociferously vocal, if that's a good expression, our desire for peace, our determination to do things in practical advance for peace, and particularly for those that we come to believe are struggling and striving for peace. I think that there is no nation in the world that is ready completely to defy mass world peace. And I believe that if it is, it is going to kill whatever chances it had of advancing its own theories in the countries where it has not yet gained control, of course. So let's don't forget the value of example, moral rectitude, honesty, of all of the virtues that we think are included in the great religion. Now, on the practical side, the question, of course, becomes far more difficult. And I should say the first is this. In recognition of the very complexity of the fact of truth and speaking, each man put to himself and to the cause for which he stands to try to inform himself. I don't mean merely to read your newspapers, but to obtain the most factual accounts you can of these various histories, these various the histories of them. And then to use what time we can in contemplation. I think we surrendered